Okay, good morning, everyone. Sorry for the setup, just because we have the big tickle nail program tonight. So, yeah, learning program. If you're feeling up at 10 o'clock at night, please. We do. I just got off my jet lag. Now we're going to kill it again tonight. Okay, so, but I wanted to do a group today anyway, because tonight's actually a special night, it's Shavuot. As we know, we'll come to it later. We're going to connect something we're talking about today to that as well. But just first to start off with a bit of a review on what we did last week. We started talking about the concept of narcissism in the last few decades, the rise of narcissism, based on the work of Keith Campbell and Jean Twenge. I'm finding this topic actually quite interesting. I have to say, it's good to hear some sane voices out there. Anyway, so we talked about that in its extreme, it's a pathology, it's a disorder. But it comes from somewhere, so we need to understand where it comes from, what leads to it. It doesn't just happen, apart from a small minority of people. And also, there's not just a rise in the technical sense of narcissistic disorder, but there's also big rise in narcissistic behavior, which they've discovered through their research. So we need to understand that and then do something about it, even though, as we said last week, it's overwhelming, but a little bit of light pushes away a lot of darkness. So we discussed the role of where it all came from. So first we discussed the role of celebrity culture, social media, where everything is totally focused on what we do and publicizing every move that we take and every snack that we eat and every, everything that comes our way. But in the research of these two researchers, they went a bit deeper than that, and actually they blamed an earlier movement, which they called the self-esteem movement. And last week we discussed the role of self-esteem in a positive way and the difference between good self-esteem and bad self-esteem. And we did it using a model from Hasidic teachings, which is the famous idea that we have two souls, the godly soul and the animal soul. And that we talked about the understanding, and this is part of the confusion, that our animal soul, which is animalistic and impulsive, that's our conscious self, actually. Very few people, they live consciously the whole time with their godly soul. But on the other hand, the godly soul is the true self. In other words, there's the conscious self and the real self. So when self-esteem focuses on our ego, which is the animal soul, and makes us all wonderful, that's a problem, because it's actually not so wonderful. It's born with a lot of weaknesses and strengths. Traits that need to be channeled, need to be refined, need to be disciplined, need to be sometimes removed. So, and we need to take responsibility for all of that. So that's the problem, where the, what he calls the self-esteem movement, is more the self-esteem of telling kids even, or ourselves, that we're wonderful and we're okay and we're good the way we are. We're not, because our conscious self, we're not good where we are. And we have a lot of competencies, but we also have a lot of weaknesses which we have to take responsibility for. The good self-esteem is more the real worth that we have, the real self-worth, which is the intrinsic worth, which is the concept of our godly soul, which we focus, and that really is what really defines us. And that's what we need to focus on. And when we understand that our true self is always pure and always good, because it comes from the real self, not the conscious self, then that strength of knowing what the real self is actually gives us the ability to take responsibility for our conscious self and to work with it and to improve. Before we go to today's topic, just an interesting thing. I'm going to share it with you. Maybe you saw it, because things, I share things with people that go on around on WhatsApp and then tell me they've seen it 7 times already, because just like it's viral and went to me, it might have come to you too. So, but I'll share it anyways. I thought it was unbelievable. A thing that came out of Michigan. A bus. Did you see this? A bus that was saved?
Amazing.
No? Oh, okay. Some people haven't seen it, so I'll share it with you. It's good. So it's an unbelievable thing, just about technology, the role of technology. So there's a 7th grader called Dylan Reeves. And what happened was, he was on a bus, a school bus, with all his mates. Right?
He took over the thing.
And he saved the whole bus, right? Because what happened was, the driver went into some sort of health disorder, like a heart attack or a fit or whatever. And he saw what was happening. He ran over, put his foot on the pedal, on the brake, and grabbed the steering wheel and then asked someone to call 911. Real kid, a 7th grader, an absolute hero. But the question that was then asked was, why was he the only one that noticed what was happening? And it came out that he was the only one on the bus that didn't have a smartphone. Right?
Yeah, because
the parents wouldn't give him
one.
Parents wouldn't give him a smartphone. Oh. But it's not just that it happened to be a technical thing. It's actually a real problem. That people buried in this, right, people are buried in their technology, actually are not aware of what's going on in the world. It affects relationships, we've talked about this before, but I thought it was a fascinating story. Anyway, it's worth reflecting on. And the truth is, the kid realized it was, and he actually, even after the story, he still wasn't, you can see from his expression, he still wasn't 100% sure if his parents were right. But that's not the role of children to know their parents are right, it's the role of parents to know what to do. Nothing, it's really not relevant if the kid thinks it's right or not. And they are going to put it off as much as they can, which is what should be happening. Okay. So before we go into the meat of discussion today, I want to just do a little bit more of the understanding of what is narcissistic behavior. Because, you know, the focus on self, the truth is everyone focuses on themselves a little bit, right? We all have an ego. And we all sometimes value ourselves maybe incorrectly. We overrate ourselves, right? It's just part of being. It's part of being human. Part of having an animal soul, really. So, in the book that the book from Melbourne and what's her name, Manning, whatever, she says the following, a very interesting thing. She says, this is universal that we sort of focus on ourselves, but there's a big difference, right? She says like this: indeed, many people present to others more attractive version of themselves, an ego ideal rather than a realistic sense of self. It's also true. That people's claims become more modest in the presence of people that know them well. So we tend to promote ourselves, but when we're in the presence of people that know us well, we tend to a little bit be more honest. Not completely, but a little bit more, right? This is some kind of reality principle working, however imperfectly. So that's just a person with regular ego. In a narcissistic person, in contrast, these twists, these swerves become somersaults on the high wire, a psychological acrobatic exercise in holding reality at bay. Right? Narcissists temper their claims for no one. Doesn't matter who they're in the presence of. Because they really believe it. In other words, most of us have a little sense of honesty with us, right? We overrate ourselves, but we kind of also know sometimes. Right? So narcissists temper their claims for no one, even when among people close to them who know their claims to be false. They rate highly on the self-deception and denial. The self-serving orientation takes an almost universal characteristic to an extreme. It says she goes on to say that a narcissist will brag about being smarter, richer, more successful, and better looking. This is the second point, but not about being more caring and compassionate. Mm-hmm. It's not really a huge value. So a person with ego will say, yeah, I'm a very nice person, I do that. Right? More important than this, even a narcissist is prepared to pay a much higher price than a non-narcissist for self-enhancement and bragging. If necessary, they are willing to alienate others and even to lose friends by impressing them with their superiority. So there's a huge difference. In other words, it's complete denial, complete self-grandizement. Grandizement. Now, so that's a real problem. It's amazing. I've always wondered, like, how that is. I mean, some people just kill a whole career, kill everything they worked for, just to keep promoting the same self-lie, which is amazing. But apparently it's a thing, right? The other thing is... Sorry about that. That's okay, don't worry. So the other thing is like this, right? The other thing is that... Yeah, we're good. The other thing is that we also know that one of the things that narcissism, a real narcissism, brings to... And we'll break this down a bit in the coming weeks because that's a quite important topic. It affects relationships because actually narcissistic people don't have an ability to really love. They have an ability to be romantic originally, which is all self-serving, but not to really love, right? And the other thing that happens is that they actually are not good leaders. After all, after a while, they just put everyone off. So just to finish that little idea, she actually talks about narcissism as a disorder. In the DSM, which is like the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, right, which was published in 2013, they went through the nine signs of a narcissist. It's interesting. I'll share it with you. And they say that if you have more than five or more of these things, then that's like a diagnosable sort of measure for narcissism. So the first one, I'll just run through them quickly. The first one was a grandiose sense of self-importance without equal achievement, without commensurate achievement. Right? You know, that's also an important thing, right? Sometimes the self-aggrandizement is also because there's nothing to show for it. It's like, that's why the difference between arrogance. Sometimes the person can achieve a lot, so they have what to be arrogant about, which is wrong, because you still shouldn't be arrogant. Everything is God-given, and the talents are God-given, and so on. But so we should be humble about even our achievements. But narcissism is really self-aggrandizement without achievement. That's a problem, right? A preoccupation with fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, beauty, and ideal love. Number three, a belief that he or she is special and unique and can only be understood by or should be associated with other special high-status people. Right? Four, a requirement of excessive admiration. That's number four. Number five is a sense of entitlement. That's a big one. Entitlement is a huge, huge issue. And we live in a very big culture of entitlement, which is a problem. Number six is interpersonally exploitative. In other words, they exploit and take advantage of others. Number seven, a lack of empathy. That's another very big one, right? The inability to have really compassion for other people. Number eight, envy of others, or belief that others are envious of him or her. And number nine, a demonstration of arrogant, haughty behavior or attitudes. Very interesting. I just saw a very interesting passage of the Talmud the other day. I don't know why I never properly noticed this before, but there's a volume in the Talmud that there's a custom, and Chabad also have the custom, to learn a page a day during the Omer, because it's got 49 pages, and the 49 days of the Omer, so we study it. So I normally do it, but towards the end, when it gets Shavuot and it gets busy, I run through it quickly, so I don't always pick up everything. But this one, I just caught my eye the other day, and I thought about it, and it's really what we're talking about, right? So it's interesting. The Talmud quotes a contradiction between two teachings, between two earlier teachings. It quotes a later discussion, like let's say in the 3rd century or something, the 4th century, and they quoted two earlier teachings. One earlier teaching was that they bemoaned the fact, it's a piece of the Talmud that bemoans the decline of generations, the decline of moral behavior, spiritual behavior, and so on and so forth. So one teaching was that when arrogance increased, then it was very common, unfortunately, it was very common for women to start marrying arrogant people. That's what it said. Right? But it said then, that's very strange, because there's another teaching, right, that said that the man who is arrogant is never acceptable even to the members of his own household. So that doesn't seem to work, right? And quotes a source and a pasuk, a verse. And it's unbelievable how this answer is, because it's really describing on target the modern research on narcissism in terms of relationships. So the Talmud answers the contradiction the following way. The Talmud says the following. I mean, this could be both ways, men and women. It just happens to be talking about women marrying men. It says, initially, they jump to marry the arrogant people, and ultimately, the husbands become despised by them, which is part of the explanation for a lot of relationship breakdown. And this is exactly what happens. The narcissist individual is often extremely charismatic, very overly confident, and foolish, and fools people very, very superficially. It becomes a real problem. That's why people fall. It always works both ways. I'm saying this happens to be the discussion here.
It's called a love bomb.
Right, love bomb. Okay, that's a good way to say it. Right, and that's what happens. But it happens because the person is so overly confident, and people fall for that. In general, I've seen this play out so many times that I've had discussions with people, even leading up to getting engaged or dating, whatever the case is, where I can see red flags and the person doesn't see it. And they just know he's a good person, confident person. And how do they know it's a good person? Because the person told them so. Like, they told them how good they are, you know. so they believe them. I mean, why would you believe someone, right? That's what happens. You know, I've always told my kids, you know, we work the shidduch system, right? So I've often told my kids, like, the couple of points about what to look out for in dating. We don't date for very long, but there are key things that you look for, right? One of them is listening, and I've always told them, but are you interested in the person to hear what they have to say about themselves? But equally important, and mostly important, do you feel like, because they sometimes tell me, like, the conversation is very flowing, which is a very, very important thing. Flowing conversation is extremely important. But you also have to know how the conversation works. Like, is it two-way? Like, is the person, when you're listening to them and they're listening to you, but is the person genuinely interested in you? Right? It's all about themselves. Because like there's a famous, I've forgotten how it goes, there's a famous little joke, they say, the guy's talking and talking and talking, and he says to his date, okay, enough about me. Now let me hear what you think about me, right? Or something like that.
Enough about you, let's talk about me.
Yeah, something like that, yeah, right? So that's really important. So often people fall for this. It's confidence, it's self sort of, you know, talented, they're going to make it, they're going to this, they sweep people off their feet, and it's a real problem. And it's exactly what the Talmud is saying. That yes, it started to happen much more. More marriages happen with people married arrogant people. And the second teaching is also true. More marriages fall apart because they can't stand them after a while. Because it's all about them. And relationships don't work like that. Okay. Now, the conversation needs to flow, but it's not just about conversation flowing, because sometimes conversation will flow, but you don't realize that you're not being, it's a lovely conversation, but actually it's not about you and him, it's about just him, or just you, right? That's what I'm saying, it's a problem. And then there's a couple other things which we'll talk about a different time, but, no, because it is really important. There are red flags, and they can pop up, and they pop up, if you know what to look for, they often pop up very glaringly. A narcissist, or a person with narcissistic behavior, actually finds it very difficult to hide these things. If you know what you're looking for. So these things need to be addressed in terms of relationships. Okay. Now, what I wanted to talk about today was this. When they came up with their research, these are these two researchers, and this is actually from their book called The Epidemic of Narcissism, Keith Campbell and Jean Twenge, and went viral, their research. I think it was like in 2009 or something, right? There was a lot of pushback, understandably so. Because people said things like, what do you mean? We need confidence. People need confidence. We need self-esteem, right? Like we talked about last week. So the differentiation we made last week was sort of more on a philosophical level. But what I want to do today is have a look at how they respond to this and sort of extend a little bit to understand a very, very important formula. But let's see how they address it. So they talk about this. In their book, they talk about it. I didn't notice it last week because I was reading a different book, but they talk about this, and this is Keith Campbell particularly, and he says the following. He said, when our study on narcissism over the generations was covered in the press 2007-2008, a lot of people responded by saying narcissism was necessary, especially in an increasingly competitive world. And he says, quite rightly, more sort of in line with what we talked about last week, he said, this is another example of our culture's blurred distinction between self-worth and narcissism, right? So, sort of fits into what we explained last week about self-worth coming from the godly soul and narcissism being focused on the animal soul, right? And also the increasing acceptance of doing whatever it takes to get ahead. That's also an incredibly negative thing. So he says that some educators also agreed that self-admiration and even narcissism is necessary for success. We have a society in which narcissistic behavior is a good quality to have, they said, right? Now he says they're all very well intentioned. There's only one problem, that this link between that kind of narcissistic perception of yourself and success is actually not true. And he goes on to explain that narcissists love to win, but actually they're not very good at winning. Right. In other words, overconfidence backfires. That's a very simple thing, right? They not very popular bosses, as we said before. They're very bad bosses, in fact. They not good at relationships and all of these things. Now, there was a very interesting, I wanted to bring it in because I found it quite interesting before I share with you a perspective on this. It was very interesting, Keith Campbell, one of the researchers, he had a TED Talk. And it's called, I think, The Benefits of Narcissism or something. Right, and he says there's different forms of narcissism, but he spoke on that particular occasion about the grandiose form of narcissism and some of the benefits he has. Now, some of the benefits is a bit tongue-in-cheek, but he actually does say that sometimes it does work, especially on social media. He says it's not good for relationships, it's not good for leadership, and so on and so forth. But he says one place where we see this benefit of narcissism most clearly in the media is especially in social media, right? Because people who are narcissistic, if you go on social media, this is true. If you go on social media, you'll see, I mean, if you measure success by the amount of friends you have on Facebook, narcissistic people have much more friends than anyone else, right? Which is interesting because we kind of also befriend things on Facebook that we won't befriend in real life, because it's okay to do that, right? And he says, where it really struck me was this. I was teaching a seminar on narcissism, he says, in the TED Talk. And like most of my classes, I didn't type this up, by the way, there's a transcript of it, right? And like most of my classes, the students were watching their phones the whole time. So I walked over to one of the students and I wanted to see what she was looking at. And she was looking at some celebrity, one of the Kardashians, I think, driving a Ferrari in Los Angeles, right? And he says, they were doing nothing, just driving a Ferrari. And he says, so I thought, he says, this is actually quite cute. He says, and I thought, oh my God, she's a genius. Why is she a genius? He says, and he says like this, in the old days, if you want to do like a reality show, right, you had to get a bunch of people, you had to have a producer, you had to have a good brand, you had to really, really work hard, right? Nowadays, you don't have to do that. If you're a celebrity, all you have to do is get on your phone, film yourself, and send it to your fans, and done. The show's done. No producer, no team, no brand. It's all good, right? So he says, well, you might say that's a bit shallow. I mean, it's not the most important thing in the world. But he goes on to say, others have used this to really, in a really positive way. And he gives an example. He says the recent application of this, in other words, this huge show sort of that plays out on social media. I don't know if some of you might remember this, was the Ice Bucket Challenge. You remember that? Mm-hmm. That was a huge thing, right? Which,
ALS.
Yeah, it was to raise awareness of ALS and which is a terrible disease, of course. The idea is you have to give money, or you dump a bucket of ice on your head, and you have to challenge a friend to do that. And he says it actually worked. The tool that was used initially, which is an interesting concept, the tool was used almost was a narcissistic tool. It was that sort of showiness on Facebook, and people who are able to garner so many friends and were popular started this, and therefore all their friends followed. And it's actually a positive application of what he calls even of grandiose narcissism, right? Because who else would want to do this, right? Hey, look, check me out. I've got my ice bucket. It's great, right? It's not. So it was narcissism, but it's not just narcissism. It's also fun, and it was for a good value, and so on and so forth. And a lot of people got involved. So therefore, he says, there's a way we can use some of this narcissism to be very positive. So it's interesting in terms of language, right? Because, yes, the tool that was used there is narcissism. And going back to this whole discussion again about we need confidence, we need self-esteem, and so on and so forth, how does it all play together? So I wanted to share with you a perspective, which... Because I actually think the people who did the ice bucket thing were not narcissists. They might have been using a tool which looks like narcissism, but it actually wasn't narcissistic at all. And that'll also explain this perspective, how it actually works, having a bit of confidence, but at the same time not having narcissistic behavior. So it all depends what's the foundation and where it starts. So, as I said, I'm going to connect it to Shavuot. Tonight is Shavuot for the next 2 days, starting tonight. Some of us have had this discussion before. It's a very, very important festival, actually. Unfortunately, a bit ignored nowadays, not like Pesach or Rosh Hashanah. The reason why I say it's a really, really important festival is because actually it's the foundation of Jewishness. It's when we got the Torah at Mount Sinai. And in fact, if you look at the verses to do with Pesach, right? It's very clear from the Chumash and the whole story of Pesach and the Exodus from Egypt that the purpose of the Jews leaving Egypt was not to leave Egypt. The purpose was to arrive at Har Sinai and to commit to the moral compass of the Torah and God's values and become God's nation, and which was all happened at Har Sinai 7 weeks later. So in fact, Shavuot is the culmination of what Pesach is all about. So first of all, I'll throw in a commercial there. Try and mark Shavuot in some way. Light candles tonight at 4:39 if you can. Or before a little bit, or a little bit after, it's also good. Not too much after because it gets dark afterwards. It's a yontif, like we'd light candles on Shabbat, try light candles tonight. If you're able to go for a half an hour to shul tomorrow to hear the Ten Commandments, that's a really, really powerful thing. If you don't have a shul to go to, come here at 10:30, we'll hear the Ten Commandments, stay for 20 minutes and leave. But you can stay, we'll have a cheesecake kiddush afterwards as well, but if you don't have time, that's fine.
What's the origin of
that's a very, very big custom. Lots of reasons about, I've done a whole study of this, so there's like 10, 20 reasons on it. But the main idea is, one of the ideas is that the Torah is compared to milk because of its sweetness, milk and honey. As the Pasuk says, that's one of the reasons. Also, we know that Moses, after the Mount Sinai, went up on the mountain for sets of 40 days. and learned Torah from God, learned oral Torah from God after it was given on Shavuot. And chalav, the word for Hebrew in milk for chalav is 40. That was the gematria, the numerical value of chalav, which is milk, is 40. Also, it's a food of babies, the idea of freshness, that you can, no one's too old to learn. You can always say, no one should say, I've got too much baggage and I'm lost. No, we can always, each day we're like a little baby, fresh, ready to receive. And then there's, of course, cheese. Not just milk, but cheese, cheesecake, cheese blintzes. I see Rav Shua just walked in, so they're selling flowers. Next door, if you want to go with some flowers for Shavuot, it's also a custom Shavuot because the mountain of Sinai was a mountain, but on the day of Matan Torah, miraculously it grew grass and flowers and was very beautiful and so on. It's also the festival of Bikurim, where they used to bring the first fruits at the time of the temple. So it's special. Anyway, try market on some level. But let's talk about what actually happened there. And there's an amazing formula that will shed light on this concept as well. And that is like this. We know that, you see, the self that we have, right? We talk about focus on self, or self-absorption, or ego, and all that kind of stuff. But we also know that self, what we have in terms of our competencies, in terms of our talents, in terms of our personality, in terms of our individuality, is a godly creator. It's not wrong, right? When we talk about self-negation, we've talked about this before, we don't mean becoming a nothing, right? Which is why, and I'll get back to just the reason for milk foods, and it's also connected to it, right? We've talked about this idea before, that on Pesach we eat only matzah, because that's a symbol of humility, complete loss of self. We don't rise, there's no rising there, right? Yet, interestingly enough, 7 weeks later on Shavuot, there was a sacrifice brought in the temple called Shtei Halechem, two breads. It was a sacrifice brought on the altar, which was accompanied by two breads, two big breads. And those two breads actually not only didn't have to be matzah, but they had to be chametz. Had to be chametz. Right? Which is very strange. Now, just to break for a second, one of the reasons we eat milk on Shavuot actually comes from there as well, because some people are very particular on a yontif to eat meat. Right? Because it's associated with joy. There's a concept of eating meat on a yontif. When it comes Shavuot, we eat milk, but you can't eat them together, of course. So when you come back from shul tomorrow, you eat milk first. Then you take a break, and then you eat meat. So it comes like two meals, and those two meals commemorate the Shtei Halechem, the two breads that was brought in the temple. Now, another reason. Okay. But coming back to the Shtei Halechem, which had to be chametz, it's a really strange thing. 7 weeks ago, we get told that chametz is such a terrible thing. It's arrogance. It's a symbol of arrogance. Even the most minute form of rising, right, is just a symbol of small arrogance, and small ego can kill you. And all the drushes we've given around Pesach. And then 7 weeks later, we say, you know, actually, chametz is a mitzvah. Make up your mind. Is it a bad thing or a mitzvah? And the answer is that's not a contradiction at all, for reasons we'll soon see. Because at the beginning of our cycle, we need to know we have an ego, and if anything that we do, if we express our personality through our ego, in other words, if we express ourselves through our ego, it's always bad. I mean, not that we're all pure from this, but the concept, right? It's always a negative thing. To express something through ego is always a negative thing. That's why the starting point has to be get rid of our ego. I mean, work, that's an aspirational idea, but negate ego. When we become free from its trying, when we become free from our own self-incarceration, step one is lose yourself. As the Maharal of Prague says, lose yourself completely. Become, we've talked about this before Pesach, positive poverty. In other words, have nothing, because you have to get rid of everything of yourself in order to get rid of your ego. But then we have the period of the Omer. And the period of the Omer is 7 weeks, which represent the seven emotions of the human being, because it's a period of refinement. That's why we have 7 weeks. Each week's for another chesed, gevurah, tiferet, and so on, right? Because we're supposed to work on ourselves. We're supposed to reintroduce self, but not through the prism of arrogance, but rather through the prism of humility. Because humility doesn't mean becoming a nothing, as we've talked about many times. Humility means not being absorbed in self, not giving yourself credit for everything that you achieve, not being locked in yourself so you can't make room for others. It does not mean not using self. The self that God created is very important. The problem with most of us is, and the problem with this rise in narcissism is, that the self itself is not bad, but the self is being expressed through the lens of tremendous ego. That's wrong. That's why the beginning of the process, you've got to get rid of the ego. That's matzah. But after a period of self-refinement, God says, okay, now you're ready for chametz. You must use self. I want you to use yourself. I created everyone differently. I created everyone with the uniqueness. And you need to use it. But you have to use it in a refined context and a humble context. And that's why the two breads on Shavuot are chametz. Now, how does this play out on Shavuot in many different ways? So, I'm going to share with you this idea. So the Talmud says that the Torah was given tomorrow, over 3,300 years ago, but spiritually each year on Shavuot. The Torah was given on Mount Sinai. Why Mount Sinai? So there's a midrashic description in the Talmud, a very fascinating thing about a machloikas, about a dispute that broke out among the mountains. Right? So it says, there was Har HaKarmel, there was a mountain called Har HaKarmel, there was Har Tavor, which is a very wide mountain, Har HaKarmel, which is a very tall mountain. And each one claimed, says the midrash, that the Torah should be given on them. Because Torah is such an unbelievable thing, the Ten Commandments, the revelation of God, the one time huge event in Jewish history, which is the most amazing event that ever happened to the Jewish people, it should happen on an important mountain, not some shmata. It should be a chash of a mountain, right? With Yichus, a mountain with Yichus. And the Medrash says that Har Sinai sort of didn't even throw in the candidacy because the Har Sinai didn't think, I'm a small mountain, I'm not going to. So God said, no, the Torah has to be given on a mountain because Torah is associated with humility, the ability to learn, the ability to connect with God, the ability to connect with the learning of God, and so on and so forth. It needs to be on a humble mountain, and therefore Har Sinai is the winner. Humble mountain was the lowest of all mountains. So the obvious question that all the commentaries asked, if humility was so important, if being a low mountain was so important, and humility was such an important vessel and such an important route to be able to connect to the Torah, to be able to connect to God, to be able to function as a healthy, purposeful, meaningful human being, so why a mountain altogether? Give it in a valley. Even better. Let's have a valley, a big valley, and the Torah, revelation will be there. And the answer is no, because being a mountain is an important thing, but you've got to be a humble mountain. Because the purpose of the Matan Torah, the purpose of creation, and the purpose of a human being is not to delete self. That's not the purpose. Because self can be very important. The confidence to get on social media and to make a bucket challenge is a very important thing. It's about giving to others, about raising awareness for health. It's about helping other people. It's amazing. You need confidence with that. Some shmata is not able to do that. Some person is very insecure and shy and doesn't want friends on Facebook is not going to be able to do that, right? So you need that, but you need that in the context of humility. You need that for the greater good. You need to be able to use that for a higher purpose, not to be absorbed in yourself, not to promote yourself, but to promote morality, to promote goodness, to promote meaning, to promote purpose. So a mountain is a good thing if it comes in the context of humility. I'll share with you an idea. I might have shared this many years ago, but it's a beautiful concept that I once saw in a Hasidic book. Hasidic commentary, and it hasn't got to do with this time of the year or this parsha or anything, but it's got to do with a parsha that comes up in a number of weeks. One of the stories of the Torah is the story of Korach. Korach was a person in the time of Moses in the desert, related to Moses, who led a rebellion against Moses. Right? I don't know if you're familiar with the story, but at the end, God punished him and his men and his people and his company, and they actually there was this. An opening in the ground, and they all got swallowed up. And we have one of the parshas of the week. There's 53 Torah portions in the Torah, right? That we read every Shabbat. Not the Shabbat, because it's second day Yontif, which would be a different one, but we read about Yontif more, but it's this 53 portions. One of them is called Korach. It's the story of Korach. And the question is asked, the commentators ask the question, why call a parsha of the Torah Korach? That's a kind of a negative thing. Could we find a different name for the parsha? Okay, it has the story of Korach, and it's got some lessons learned from Korach, but, you know, there's other ways to call the name of the parsha. Why would you call an entire Torah portion with a person who was a negative person, who led a rebellion, who was very self-absorbed, very, very into his own competing with the leadership of Moses and so on and so forth? Why would we call the parsha Korach? And one of the answers given is this, that Korach had a redeeming factor. What was Korach's problem? So things like this. He had a very big issue. I'll just give you a bit of background so you'll be able to bring out this point. He had a very big issue with roles in Judaism, right? For example, we know that there was a small family in the time of the desert. Now it's lots of people, but it was a full family who were designated as the Kohanim, right? They were Kohanim. They were the people who went into the Holy of Holies. They were the people that brought incense in the temple. They were the people who served God in a very spiritual way in the temple. And in the desert, it was Aaron. Aaron, Moses' brother, was chosen by God to be the Kohen. And him and his children and all their descendants. So today, we don't have rituals in the service in the temple, but we still have certain unique roles that Kohanim do. For example, tomorrow is Yom Tov. If you go to shul, there's the priestly blessing. So a Kohen blesses the congregation. They get the first call up to the Torah, whatever the case is, right? There's still a specialness about Kohanim. And Korach was upset about this. He said, I also want to be, not only wanted to be a Kohen, but he wanted to be a Kohen Gadol. Like there was a high priest, right? Why only Aaron? I also want to be a Kohen Gadol. I also want to be able to put incense onto a pan and go into the Holy of Holies with all of its amazing divine revelation. I want to do that too. And in Rashi, in the Korach story, there's a very interesting comment because Moses, because you know, everything in the Chumash is very brief. And sometimes we need a bit of oral Torah to explain what happened there, to explain the actual dialogue. And Rashi brings to the Midrash that what happened was like this. Moshe Rabbeinu turned to Korach and he says, this doesn't happen. God doesn't work like that. Not everyone has the same role. Every role is important, but not everyone has the same role. That's the way Judaism works. We have different roles. There's Kohanim, there's Levim, etc., right? So he says, and then part of the conversation was, Moses turned to Korach and says, you know, I got to tell you a secret. Afani, I also want to be a Kohen Gadol. I also want to be. But I can't. That's for Aaron. I have a different role. I mean, Moses' role is pretty important, but he's also there. And what was Moses trying to teach him? Moses was saying like this, Afani, I also want to be, in other words, I am no problem with your ambition. Ambition is a good thing. But you have to know what you can be ambitious about. Right? You can't undo structures. You can't undo systems. You can't undo other people. You can't undermine other people in the root of your ambition. Right? And that's why we actually call the parasha with the name Korach. Because Korach is a symbol of ambition, and ambition in its pure form is not bad. It just needs to be applied properly. How does it have to be applied? So this is the idea that I saw once. Amazing idea. Korach had 250 men with him. And Moshe Rabbeinu gave them a challenge. He says, okay, you know what? You all want to be a Kohen Gadol? It's fine. Come tomorrow morning with your pan, copper pan, and put coals, incense, go into the Holy of Holies, and offer up incense to God, just like the Kohen Gadol does, and see if it works. And they took the challenge. Silly. In other words, they knew it wouldn't work, but right? They went in, and Korach and his family were swallowed up on the ground, but the rest of them were actually burnt by fire. There was a fire that came out from God and actually killed them because they were doing a terrible sin. And they weren't supposed to be there, and it was wrong. Right? Okay, fine, we understand. The next thing we read in the Torah is God speaks to Moses and says like this, gather all the pans that they used, right? Now remember, these were pans that they used to rebel against Moses and to rebel against God's structure, right? Take the pans, melt them down, and create a cover for the altar. This is the altar in the temple, in the Mishkan that was in the desert, right? Create a cover for the altar. That's what you should do with these pans. And this great Hasidic rabbi asked this question. He says, this is crazy. You want everything pure in the altar. You want in the Mishkan, you want everything. You don't want anything that has baggage to it to make an altar for God. You're taking, God says he wants those pans? Those pans of rebellion? That's what you're going to put on the altar? That's going to be the cover of the altar? See, he says an amazing thing. He says the pans themselves were not bad. It's the arrogance that drove them that was bad. Now, and this is what God was teaching us. What's the altar? In the Mishkan, in the desert, was different to the in Jerusalem. In the desert, the altar was made out of sand, earth. It's called Mizbeach Adama, an altar of earth. And this copper, the pans that were melted down, was going to cover over the earth. Earth, in Kabbalah, is always a symbol of humility. Because it's the lowest thing, dust, earth, right? So God was saying, those pans are not bad. It's the arrogance, the narcissism that drove them that was bad. But if you take those pans and you put them on Mizbach Adama, you put them on an altar of humility. In other words, if humility drives the ambition, then ambition is holy. And that's why that ambition has to be put, not with them, it's got to be melted down and replaced on top of the altar of earth. Because when the foundation is humility, then the ambition is good. Same idea. If someone wants to get up, it takes strength. Right? Unless you're a real narcissist, which in case you just don't mind putting yourself out there, but those real narcissists actually don't do very good for other people. It's more about them. But the type of tool to go put yourself out on Facebook, for example, and to make a real challenge that works, right, with unbelievable confidence and to attract followers and friends, for what? To help medical research and help other people? That's holy. That's good. Why? It's the same tool. It's the same confidence. It's the same putting yourself out there. It's the same method, same strategy. But its foundation was humility. It was about other people, about a greater purpose, about doing something good to help healing, to help health for other people. So he's right. Well, he didn't quite understand is how it works Kabbalistically, but he's correct. And that's the whole chametz thing also. Because when our self is driven by ego, it's terrible. But our self is not terrible. It's the what normally inspires self that's the problem. And we become more self-absorbed, we become more into ourselves, and we close ourselves off to other people. And to our greater good, we become completely imprisoned in ourselves. And when it gets bad, it becomes really bad, like we see today, where people just talk about self the whole time. But it's a self driven by arrogance, not by self-absorption. It's not a self driven by morality and good things. It's not driven by humility. When it's driven by humility, we have to be confident. We have to be comfortable, able to inspire, to teach, to share, to do for others, to have the strength to stand up for good things. And so on. There's so much that we need self for, each in our own way. When it's driven by humility, when it's on the altar of earth, when it's a mountain but it's a low mountain, it's based on humility, then a mountain is a good thing, it's not a bad thing. But it's got to be a low mountain, a humble mountain. All right? And the same thing, again, just in connection with Shavuot, I'll just share with you another fascinating concept that we see in the experience of Matan Torah. Just a few days, Shavuot tomorrow is the sixth day of the month of Sivan. A few days ago, we had Rosh Chodesh Sivan, the first day of Sivan. And historically, that was the day that the Jews arrived at Har Sinai. They arrived at the mountain. They arrived at the location where the divine revelation, the Torah, the Sinai experience would actually take place. And there's a very interesting little language in the Torah there. It says that they came there. They came to what's called Midbar Sinai, which was then the Sinai Desert. I don't know if it's the same place today, but Sinai Desert. And they camped there. Now, every time in the Torah, the Jews camped many times, right? 42 times in the desert. They stopped and started until they got to Israel. But when it says in the Torah that they camped somewhere, it uses the language Vayachanu, they camped. With one exception, when they came to Sinai Desert to get the Torah, it says Vayichan, and he camped. Which is a singular language, right? So the Talmud tells us that there was an unbelievable oneness, unbelievable to unity, right? And what happened was, Vayichan, he camped like one person with one heart. They were so united, so focused, so understanding what they're here for, what they focused on, and where their destination is, that God said, now's the time to give the Torah, because the Torah needs humility and the Torah needs unity. Which unity, by the way, comes from humility, because we connect it to other people. Now, one of the things, which perhaps we'll talk about more in the coming weeks, but one of the things that they talk about in the literature of narcissism is the focus on individualism, right? Where everyone has to be their own individual. You know, this is my journey, my truth, my destination, my this, my that, right? And I'm different, I'm unique, and which is all true, we are unique. So here's also another question, it's the same idea. Where does individualism fit in to the whole process? And from a Jewish perspective, how do we look at individualism? And the answer is that if you look a little bit further in the story of Sinai, individualism is an incredibly important thing. How do I know that? Because we also learn that when God gave the Ten Commandments, which we're going to read in Shul tomorrow, look at the language of the Ten Commandments, right? Now, how did Mount Sinai work? Just give you a bit of a scenario, right? Everyone was at Mount Sinai. Men, women, and children were all there at that moment. There was one time where everyone had this divine revelation experience. We are taught not only was everyone who was alive was there, but all future souls were there. We were all there, right? At this amazing event. And God reveals himself and God speaks to everyone. And he says, he's talking to a few million people, or if you want to include the souls, millions of people, right? And he says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I am God, your God. But in Hebrew, all words are conjugated, either in singular or plural, right? So if you look at it, it's not plural. He's talking to millions and billions of people, but he's saying, I am Hashem, your God. Because we are taught that when God gave us the Torah, He spoke to every individual separately. I am your God in the singular because you matter as an individual. Because I'm asking everyone to commit. I'm asking everyone to become my nation. I'm choosing you all of my nation collectively. But each person has a unique mission. The individual is really important. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, because no two people are alike. And every person has, although we all submit to common values and so on, but application of those values, we all have a very specific way of doing it. We all have, God created each of us with a different personality, and we all have, with our personality and ourself that He created, we all have a special way and a special contribution to make that no one else could make. Otherwise, God wouldn't have created me. If He didn't think that I have an additional, unique contribution to make. So God talks to the individual because the individual is important. But when does God talk to the individual? Here's the key. When does He talk to the individual? He talks to the individual as the individual is standing with millions of other people to become one united nation. In other words, God doesn't talk to the individual who separates him or herself from everyone else to become focused on self and to not leave room for others. That's an individual who's not humble. That's an individual who whose individuality or individualism is being inspired by ego and eventually by narcissism. God says the individual is important, but not as an arrogant individual, as an individual who's part of the destiny of billions of other people. An individual who can make room for all those people standing Har Sinai. An individual that knows that he's not the end and be all and end all of everything, but just like he or she is an individual, a very unique individual, a very special individual, so are the other 600,000 or 3 million or billions of souls that are standing at the same time at Har Sinai, hearing the same message from the same God in an individual way. So that's the answer. So getting back to the beginning of the discussion, this is the confusion that people have. When people say, but you need a bit of confidence. You need a bit of narcissism. You need a bit of individuality. That is true. But it's not something we have to struggle for. It's two separate discussions. It's a different sense of self. It's a different sense of confidence. Of course we need confidence. And we need strength. And we need confidence to stand up sometimes. And all of that. And we need to use the talents and strength and competencies that God gave us. But it's got to be on the mountain of Sinai, the lower mountain. It's got to be together with other people in our own individual way. And it's got to be ambitious. The pans of Korach. But the ambition that lies on the altar of earth. Because it's got to be inspired by a sense of humility. And that's why in the seven emotions, we've talked about this before. The seven emotions, you know, the three triangles, right? Chochma bin Adas, the intellect, and then the Chesed, Gvura, and Tiferet. Then you have the last triangle, which is the ancillary, the supportive triangle. It's the one on the right is Netzach. Netzach means ambition, winning. And the other one on the left is Hod, which is humility, because they have to go together. If you have Netzach without Hod, the Hod without Netzach doesn't work. We have to have Netzach, we have to have ambition, but it's got to be inspired by the Hod, by the humility. And the humility must not bring to a self-degradation, it's got to inspire ambition, but healthy and humble ambition. So that's the answer, that's the formula to the problem, to the pushback of highlighting narcissism and then saying it's a negative thing, and then people saying, but hold on, you need confidence, and you need this, and all that, all true, but it's a different confidence. It's a confidence, not just a matter of balance, not just a matter you need a small dose or a big dose. It's not about a small dose or a big dose. It could be a huge dose. But if it's coming from the right place, if it's coming from a sense of humility, a sense of purpose, a sense of oneness with other people, a sense of wanting to live for a higher purpose, it's always good. And its application will be different. It'll never be a confidence or an ambition that undermines others along the way, or breaks or undoes, like Korach wanted to do, undoes God's structures or systems or important systems or structures and something like that. But it'll always be, because it's coming from humility, it'll always be placed in the right place. It'll always be with reflection, with knowing, am I taking people with me or am I putting other people down? Am I undermining other people to win myself or am I just being right? Because confidence is a good thing. That, for example, like jealousy is a good thing. The Talmud says that I've mentioned this many times, that the jealousy among the wise increases wisdom, right? Because what's the sign of good jealousy, for example? Same idea. Good jealousy is good when it's first of all for a higher purpose. It's about being jealous and aspiring and ambitious to reach spiritual heights or wise heights that other people have reached, and also not to put others down, right? Because the self-grandizement that comes, narcissism, is always that not only that I should have the focus on myself, but there shouldn't be a focus on other people. That's what it comes with, right? Because it's inspired by arrogance. When it's inspired by humility, it can be strong, it can be a huge dose, and it should be, but inspired by humility, so it keeps it in check. It doesn't put other people down. It's for a higher purpose. It's for a greater calling, and it's with a sense of oneness with other people. More to come on this topic in the coming weeks. Have a wonderful day. Wish everyone a Chag Sameach. And Shabbat Shalom.